Let's come to order. We don't have our quorum. We have the most important members here, I think, though, the ones who really want to work, and the most important members of the public and the audience. Thank you for coming, and above all, Mr. Hoffman is here. So, we're going to spend the first bit of time. We have two bills up, and I think we're going to split the time about evenly between this part and those. But we have ample time to go as reasonably deep as maybe not fiscal immersion today, Mr. Hoffman, but if you can, I presume you have a presentation in mind, and I want to thank you for coming. So,
all right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members should have in their packets a document which explains changes in
Mr. Forecast. Hoffman, you have to tell us that you're Mr. Hoffman.
I'm George Hoffman from the Department of Human Services. All right, thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Oh, welcome to the committee.
Members should have a copy of this document in their packets. It's a narrative document that explains the forecast changes in the February forecast. We have two major forecast documents that we make available. One is this narrative explanation of the forecast changes I've just pointed you to. And the other, which we have occasionally given you on paper, is an 80-page packet that has a lot of detail about history and forecast in the programs. It's my understanding that you have a PDF of that material available on the committee's website. If you're actually going to use that material, you might find it handier to refer to the spreadsheet version of that material, which is on the reports and forecast webpage, and which we can easily make available to the committee if anybody wants it.
And for the public, if they can't figure out what Mr. Hoffman just said, if they call my office at 651-296-1729, we can walk them through that. It is fascinating, but it's very detailed.
And if members of the public are looking for our webpage, which is not always easy to find, I believe you can find it if you search for my name, George Hoffman. Okay, our general fund forecast our general fund forecast for the current biennium is down $180 million. It's a decrease of about 1.9%. It's a little more of a change than we normally see in February because we have only a few months of additional data at this point. All of the decrease in the general fund forecast can be considered to come from the medical assistance program, because the medical assistance forecast is down $188 million. So the change in medical assistance is a little bit more than the overall change in the general fund programs. And the biggest factor in the medical assistance change is our change in the forecast for the MA expansion for adults without children. And that accounts for about $108 million out of the $188. There is an explanation on this. The document on the changes goes through all of the medical assistance activities, five different major activities. The part on the adults without children you can find on page 9. And most of the change here is that we have reduced the enrollment forecast by about 9% in the current biennium. We have seen enrollment in this expansion actually.
Mr. Hoffman, we have a quorum, so your comments can be official now. Thank you. Welcome back to the official committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We saw enrollment in this part of medical assistance actually fall between July and December. We had expected it to be going up. What we believe is happening is that people there were two large program groups that went into this coverage. We had a historical GAMC population of about 30,000 people. We had Minnesota Care enrollment of about 50,000 people. And these two groups, Minnesota Care people with income under 75% of the poverty level, and the historic GAMC population, are the groups who went into this program. Now, in addition to that 80,000, we were expecting to see some additional growth of more uninsured people being picked up by the program. We said in the November forecast that seems to be less than we thought. And then by the time we got to January, we saw that the enrollment had actually fallen instead of going up the way we expected it to. And what seems to be happening is that people who would have stayed in Minnesota Care are not staying enrolled as consistently in the medical assistance program. Now, there are two factors that probably contribute to that. One is that eligibility in the Minnesota Care program is only reviewed every 12 months. In the medical assistance program, there is an income review every 6 months. So there's a more frequent review. And were they still in Minnesota Care, and if their income went up, they would have stayed eligible for the Minnesota Care program. They would have had a higher premium, but they would still be in the program. When they're on medical assistance, if the income goes up, as it commonly does, over the low income threshold, they are no longer eligible for the medical assistance program. And so this is our best explanation of why they are not staying enrolled as well as we think they would have stayed, or for as long a time as we think they would have stayed enrolled in the Minnesota Care program. There's an additional change, and there's a little table toward the bottom of page 9 where we're also reducing the forecast of what we expect to spend on the fee-for-service coverage for this group. For this group, just the same as for MA families with children and elderly in the medical assistance program, most of the enrollees by far are mandatory for enrollment in managed care, but at the beginning of their MA eligibility, they have a period of 2 or 3 months of fee-for-service coverage. And so what we see in this segment, and it's about the same for MA families with kids, is that about three-quarters of the enrollees at a point in time are in managed care, and about a quarter of the enrollees are in fee-for-service. We have just gotten to the point that we have enough experience with the fee-for-service coverage and expenses that we can say it's coming in lower than we had been expecting before. And so that's an additional element in the decrease in forecast here. So that That's more than half of the medical assistance change. It's more than half of the general fund change.
And Mr. Hoffman, in the tails on that part, did you assume that things are going to stabilize at the current level?
When we get to January of 14, the two factors to which we are attributing the decline in enrollment in this group are going to change. The coverage is going to go up from 75 of poverty to 133 of poverty, and so we're not going to have the very low income threshold, and we're not going to have reviews every 6 months anymore, because that's not allowed under the ACA, under the federal law. So we are holding the forecast about the same after January of 14. So we have reduced the forecast. We still have it slowly going up in the direction where we thought it was going to go. And then after January of 14, the forecast is actually a little bit higher. And that's because we have more people in Minnesota Care in the group which we would expect to move to medical assistance after the income standard is 133 of poverty.
Thanks. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoffman, I've been here for 20 years, and I must say this is the first time you've ever been off by more than about 2% on anything. So this is a very unusual thing that we're watching today, and I guess it's because it's a new program that we didn't know how it was going to work out. But Mr. Hoffman is usually very, very close.
And I'm kind of happy it's in our favor. So. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hoffman, thanks. I'm not sure if you can answer this, although you can probably answer anything. I know I shouldn't say that. But if you're saying that a lot of this savings is people who are basically dropping off MA, who, if they were still in Minnesota Care, would not be dropping off, are we then seeing an increase in people who are uninsured? I mean, you're saying that this is what you think is going on, but the corollary to that would be that we're getting this bunch of people who used to be on Minnesota Care who are now just plain uninsured. Is that what we're seeing, and what's happening to those people? Is there any, ordinarily we think, well, they go to, uncompensated care, or they're just not getting care, or what?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, it's not something you can measure in such a short time, but it's a possibility. It's also possible that the economy is helping some, because we see an effect like that on the enrollment of children and parents. I just saw the publication of the 2011 insurance survey by the health department. The overall rate of uninsurance in their estimate for 2011 is essentially the same as it was in 2009. But of course, 2011, when they did the survey, is now about a year ago, so it's not really going to answer your question. I'm inclined to think this is still a new program. And I wonder if people are going to learn the ropes a little better, and we'll see some of what we're now forecasting in the way of slow enrollment increase from where it's at right now.
And Mr. Hoffman, the people could move from MA if they drop off the top of income to Minnesota Care in most cases, couldn't they?
They could go to Minnesota Care, and numbers of them move back and forth between MA and Minnesota Care. our Minnesota Care forecast for adults without children is a little bit higher in the February forecast.
All right, thanks. Representative Gottwald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think another thing you find, and Mr. Hoffman can correct me if I'm wrong, but just because people are not on public programs does not mean that they don't have coverage. And I think we all know that empirically. And we do, in fact, have a lot of people who come off of Minnesota Care and onto private coverage and sometimes move back and forth between those. So I, too, got a bit of a sneak peek at the uninsured report. And I understand that it also shows, once again, that over half of the uninsured in the state of Minnesota are already eligible for programs that we have created for them but are simply not connected to that program for whatever reason. So I think, again, we as a legislature need to be thinking about how do we connect people who are eligible for coverage to the coverage that they are eligible for, because that seems to be an ongoing problem. But just to underscore that issue, that just because somebody doesn't have or drops off of a public coverage program, that doesn't mean they don't have insurance.
Okay, thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question, because of the, we have federal matching rates for our medical assistance program, and there's a savings that was down $180 million. Is that also, let me see, would that also be a savings then for the federal government, is that correct?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, because it's a 50-50 match, basically, it would represent an equal savings for the federal government.
And Mr. Hoffman, perhaps this is a way for the feds to find $180 million in cuts they couldn't quite find before, so they could just joke. They had a hard time coming up, hitting their target, if I remember. So, what else do you have for us today, Mr. Hoffman?
If you page ahead to the families with children page 11, the basic change here is a reduction in the enrollment forecast of about 2.5%. This appears to be the effect of the economy, of the labor market getting a little better in Minnesota. In fact, it's been sounding even better since we did the forecast. But to put this in context, when leading up to the recession, we increased this forecast by about 20%. We did that in two steps. One was about 15%, and then we added a little bit more to it later. We backed the forecast down about 1.5% in the November forecast, and now we're taking it down 2.5%. So it's still, obviously, enrollment is still higher because of the state of the economy, but it basically stopped going up last 6 months ago, where we had still been expecting it to go up a little bit more and then to level off. Now our forecast is leveling it off at a lower point. And so that's the source of most of the forecast change in the children and parents part of the program. The next biggest piece of forecast change, if you page back to page 7, elderly and disabled basic care, the forecast is coming down, and most of this is because of lower fee-for-service expenditures on the disabled. The forecast is coming down approximately $40 million for the biennium. That's a 1.6% decrease. We have been looking at why expenditures were lower in the first half of the year than we expected. They were kind of lower across the board. it's a possibility that this is, at least in part, an interaction with the expansion of coverage for adults without kids. What happens on a continuing basis when we had a GAMC program was that people who were on GAMC ultimately got a disability determination and became eligible for medical assistance. And when that happened, it was typically retroactive for a period of months, even up to 2 years. We had authority from the federal government to go back up to 2 years, and if they were found disabled back to 2 years ago, we would change their eligibility to medical assistance eligibility as far back as 2 years, and then turn all those GAMC payments into medical assistance payments. The money would go back to GAMC that was spent on them, and we would pay half of state share out of medical assistance, and then get the other half, the benefit of the other half of federal funds. And so one possibility for what's going on with the disabled is that the flow of those claims being turned into medical assistance claims has changed. But it's a little early to investigate it systematically, but we're going to be taking a look at it in the next several months. It's a lesser change going forward because it's a fee-for-service change for the disabled, and we're expecting half of the MA disabled population to be going into managed care. We had a significant change on the managed care rates in the forecast in November. What we know so far puts our forecasted managed care expenditures in line with the rates, and so there isn't any change in the February forecast on that. The next biggest piece of forecast change is...
There's a question. Representative Frith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, before we get too far, Mr. Hoffman, I did want to add to this the earlier discussion of where the people are and if they're insured under MA or if they are insured in the private market. And it came to my mind that this is what's going on in my county and in Faribault, Minnesota. Between Northfield and Dundas, there's a free clinic that we've had, and I'm a health finder clinic that we nurses and doctors volunteer at. It's so large now, there's such a large group of people there that we're extending it and opening a place downtown in Faribault to care for those folks that are uninsured. And these are people that are my friends and neighbors. And there's women, you know, my age, who have lost their job. Well, they're younger than I am now. I forget I'm on Medicare now. I made it. But some didn't, aren't there yet.
Careful.
Yeah, some aren't there yet. And so, you know, they're uninsured, waiting to get Medicare. So there's that group of people, too. So there are people out there, I think, a glut of people that aren't insured because they're coming to the free clinics that we volunteer at, and we're opening another one as we speak. So I don't know in the rest of your counties if you have a lot of volunteer doctors and nurses with free clinics, but I certainly do.
Mr. Hoffman, did you want to respond, or is that just a...
Just a comment.
A comment. Okay. Representative McDonough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hoffman, I see on page 7, since you referred us back to that page, that personal care assistants have increased 2.1% for the current biennium because of a pending lawsuit. So the question is, if the lawsuit, which we assume, the state assumes, that we will win that, what happens to those funds that have already been paid out?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, we implementation of that change in rates was enjoined by the courts, and so we initially assumed that we wouldn't be able to implement that until January of 12. And then with some more information and what had happened in the case in between, we pushed that out to January of 13. I talked to one of the attorneys involved in the case, and we decided that if we assumed the state was going to prevail, that it would probably not be settled before January of 13. Now, in the meanwhile, we are paying out higher rates, and it's a possibility that the state would be allowed to act to recover those higher rates if the state prevails. But it's also a possibility that the court would not allow that even if the state prevailed. So we have not assumed we are going to get the money back, although legally that would, as I understand it, be a possibility that we would if the state prevails, take the money back that had been paid out in those higher rates.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So just for my own clarification, because I recall this conversation very clearly last year, especially meeting with some PCAs from my county, and they certainly were giving me the third degree, and being a new freshman, I was trying to understand it. So is it we in our bills reduced certain PCAs to meet the $5.2 billion deficit, and that passed, but because of a pending lawsuit, it's restored back to its original rate. Is that correct?
It was
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, it was a law that said we pay a 20% lower PCA rate if the PCA is a relative of the person being cared for under certain definition of relative. And so that's and the state was sued, and the court stopped implementation of the reduction, and so pending resolution of the case, the program is paying the full rate. So it's a matter of a lower rate for relatives of the people being cared for.
Mr. McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. I did understand it was the PCA was a relative portion.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for the clarification.
Okay.
And just on that topic, I know that certain providers are withholding that from their employees pending the outcome of this. How likely is it that there's going to be a clawback? Is that a decision of the judge, or would the department offer advice to the judge on what they would suggest, and what advice is the department going to offer the judge if he asks? You know,
I'm not on the inside of decisions like that, Mr. Chairman. So I know that MMB staff asked about the possibility of collecting money back, and we had a discussion about whether we ought to forecast we were going to get the money back. But the point that we ended up at was that we would still assume the state was going to prevail, and that's a default assumption. It's not intended to be based on the merits. Just that the state, because it was put in the law, and we have litigation, but we decided not to assume we were going to recover the difference.
Right, and I think that'd be the advice I would suggest that they offer, that just in fairness, that they would not attempt to claw back a surprise thing that's litigated, and it would go forward from some date and then be addressed at some future time. But so the money in the forecast assumes not a penny comes in from any of that savings through the end of the year, and then the savings resumes January 1st, 2014.
That's correct,
Mr. Got my years mixed up. What year is it now? Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you. And then if the case were settled in June to the disfavor of the state, then that would be taken up in the November forecast as a lack of savings, and then would be charged back against the the bottom line, I suppose. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, good. So you have more to say to us, I bet.
Okay, long-term care facilities, that's another reduction area where we have reduced the nursing home forecast about 3%. We're demographically at the very end of a pause in the growth of the demand for long-term care.
Mr. Hoffman, is that a page in here?
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. Page 3. We're back almost at the beginning.
So have you really gotten anywhere?
I went kind of backwards
after all this time.
I tried to hit the high points kind of
Thank
in
you.
Order, Mr.
That's
Chairman.
That's very good. You're doing great, Mr. Hoffman.
So we're back to page 3. The nursing facility forecast, caseload forecast, is about 3% lower. Where it's been going down. The MA nursing home caseload has been going down steadily for about 15 years. Now, part of that is the result of the development of alternative services, both in our program and outside of our program. Assisted living is the thing that you probably hear about. It's also been helped by the fact that the demographics of the last 15 years has been kind of a low point as it affects the demand for long-term care. So there has not been a lot of growth from population change in the demand for long-term care. But with the growing elderly population, that demand is going to start to grow. And we're just somewhere near the inflection point where we hit the bottom and it starts to go upward. In the area of long-term care, it's going to grow slowly but steadily. So it's not exactly a tsunami. Maybe for Social Security and Medicare, it's a tsunami, but for long-term care, it's more of a slowly rising flood. But it's going to go on for a long time. So we've observed that the caseload has continued to go down more than we had thought it would. And we have a decline in the forecast, and the decline slows in the forecast. That's as far as we're going to recognize that the demographics is going to change.
Thank you. Keep going.
Those are the main points of the medical assistance forecast. I haven't talked about waivers and home care. Those changes are all pretty small. They're summarized on page 5. And the percentage changes are all fairly small, except TBI waiver, traumatic brain injury waiver, the forecast is down. And this is basically because the number of TBI recipients has been staying flat. We had a period of very strong growth, and it kind of leveled off, and we've been expecting the growth to start up again slowly, and so far we are not seeing that kind of growth. Other programs other than medical assistance, we have a small caseload decrease in alternative care. Alternative care is on alternative care is at the beginning in the long-term care part of the forecast. Excuse me. Page 3.
We're going backwards here.
We have this funding arrangement with alternative care that what's left over in the alternative care appropriation cancels to medical assistance. And so the change in the forecast in alternative care shows up as a change in medical assistance. And the reason for the change you see on page 3, more or less in the middle of the page, is that the alternative care forecast, the alternative care caseload also is not going up. And so we are forecasting that about 2.5% lower, and that's the alternative care change.
And Mr. Hoffman, that cancel of the medical assistance, is that dispersed to the counties and in just kind of a general revenue pot they can deal with their waivers, and it's a bonus to handle problems, or is that specifically spent for something?
The alternative care program.
No, but the cancellation part. The part that cancels to the medical.
The cancellation system. Goes back to the general fund, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, it does?
Yes.
It doesn't go, okay.
And the point of the funding arrangement is that if the county demand for alternative care rises, we have funding available to open more slots in alternative care and to accommodate the demand. But if the money is not spent, to the extent the money is not spent, it cancels to the medical assistance account and then it cancels to the general fund.
Thank you. Okay, keep going.
CD fund, page 14 at the bottom. We did a substantial reduction in this forecast, in the November forecast, in part because of the medical assistance expansion for adults without kids, in part because of the 2011 session changes putting MA disabled people into managed care. We've had to backtrack a little bit on the decreases we did in November. We don't see the number of placements falling quite as fast as we expected from those changes. So we've allowed that it's going to take a while longer for those things to take effect. The change is mostly in the current fiscal year. And so that's the source of the increase of about $5.6 million in.
And Mr. Hoffman, that's a forecasted fund then?
Yes, that's
okay. That's based upon people who qualify, it's an eligibility question.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
MFIP changes on the next page 15. MFIP caseload is actually down about 3%, which is in line with the effects we see from the economy on the medical assistance enrollment of kids and parents. But because of the funding arrangements, the savings is going to the federal TANF fund, and we are having to increase the general fund part of the funding for this program. It's happening in part because the child care forecast is going down a little bit in the current biennium, and the child care expenditures serve as maintenance of effort. They help to make up the maintenance of effort that we use to justify our claim on federal funding. And basically, Mr. Chairman, you probably don't want to hear any more about it.
Oh, I don't know. No, I actually understood what you said, so I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. Does anybody have a question about this piece? No. You may flee while you can and take the next topic.
Those are the biggest changes in the forecast, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Hoffman, Representative Gottwald wants to take a crack at that topic, I guess, or some other topic. Representative Gottwald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, not to try to save time, I love going through the detail, but it does, I just want to confirm, there does appear to be a trend in what you're going through in these programs that the improving economy is helping. It's helping not kick people off government programs, but keep them from not needing them as much, perhaps, huh?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald is right. There is a theme. The economy is clearly helping children and parents, or helping parents get off of medical assistance and off of MFIP. At the same time, and maybe it's affecting single adults on medical assistance. That's a little harder to tell. We don't have the length of data series on their enrollment and the length of history to use to try to diagnose that. At the same time, our forecast for the general assistance program is a little bit higher, and that's a caseload issue. It's a small one, but this has proved to be a forecast that we raise a little bit, and we raise it a little bit, and we raise it a little bit. It seems to keep going up more than we think. And in the GRH program, if you go to page 19, that's also the source, the same group, the GA type GRH residents are also the source of some caseload increase in the GRH program. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty clear that the economy is helping families, while it's not so clear that it's helping it's helping single adults, the poorer single adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. It's nice to have something to be encouraged about. And it's nice that through the forecast for all the challenges we've seen in the economy since 08, that, you know, there's something positive we can celebrate together.
Arguably, Mr. Chairman, it's also helping the nursing home caseload. We have used a stock price index as one of the variables for the nursing home caseload, and the increase in stock prices in the high flying 90s seemed to help explain why the MA nursing home caseload was going down. It's still in our model. It's not as important anymore. But we said at the time that the wealth effect of the high-flying stock market logically might help families and help individuals pay for alternatives to nursing home care. So that it could be an element in that too.
Well, good. So is that what you have? This has been very helpful. Okay. Maybe last chance for anybody. Well, I think you're free to go, Mr. Hoffman. Thank you, and I know Ms. Vogt is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're not done with the topic. Ms. Vogt is here to talk about the. You can stay and listen to Ms. Vogt, or you can go do something else. And Mr. Hoffman, you know, I realize it's an imperfect science, and we try to be kind to you when you're here. So as you're looking at our fiscal requests, the same kind of flexibility and assumptions and the warm response would reception would be very welcome. So
we always try, Mr. Chair, to be appropriately flexible.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. I'll try to take comfort in that. So thank you. Ms. Vogt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Angela Vogt with Minnesota Management and Budget. I've been asked to do an overview of the Healthcare Access Fund, given the February 2012 forecast. We have very small changes to report related to the Healthcare Access Fund. The fund is balanced for the current biennium for 12-13 and reflects a $351 million balance by the end of fiscal year 2015. On net, the change from November is about a $5 million decrease to the balance of the fund. And the way that is reflected in the fund balance is, in fact, a change to the flexible transfer out to the general fund. And it's on a line in the kind of bottom third of your fund balance called provider and gross premium tax expansion transfer. That transfer only is done to the extent there are resources in the fund. And so in this case, a loss of $5 million in this fund translates to a loss of $5 million in the general fund. That $5 million loss to the fund for the current biennium is a combination of a couple of things. We're seeing a little bit of a decrease on the revenue side, a 1.9% decrease in revenues, mostly attributed to lower than expected collections in the provider tax since November, as well as an adjustment downward from our national consultant Global Insights that adjusted their healthcare expenditure factor downwards. In addition to that, we're also seeing decreased expenditures in the Minnesota Care Program of about 2.6%, mostly related to decreased enrollment in the MA Families and Kids Program. And so on net, the loss of revenue is actually bigger than the loss of expenditures, and so we see that net $5 million loss to the fund.
Ms. Vogt, do you have an idea why that is? Have our health costs going down? Just a slower growth than projected, which makes it the 1.9, which is quite a big change in 3 months.
It looks that is primarily a function of the Global Insights trend that was trending upwards faster than what we're actually seeing for collections, and they did adjust their own expenditures down about 1.3% in that national baseline from what they had previously projected.
What are they, do you know what they're calling trend in the healthcare industry? You know what number they're using for trend? Like what increase? Are they at 6% or 8% or something?
Yes, hang on 1 second.
I don't know if you're prepared for that. You can just duck it if you have to. Right? It's off your usual topic.
I actually have that, Mr. Chair. At this point, for a factor that they split the factors related to healthcare services versus pharmacy and medical products, they kind of look at that differently. But for fiscal 12, they're now looking at a 3.3% growth in the healthcare expenditures, and then 3.9 in fiscal 13.
Is that in commercial and just in the state program? That must be a commercial, right? That's the trend.
Mr. Chair, that's across the board, all markets. I'm going to check on that for you for sure, but yeah, this is a national baseline for the market in general.
It'd be like headline news. Minnesota
better
making
than
a difference.
8%.
Better than 8, yeah. Okay, we'll keep on going. You're doing fine.
Actually, Mr. Chair, since it's a pretty small change, that's about all I have to say, but I can tamper questions if folks have them.
All right, and just so members understand what she was talking about, this on it's the fourth column over for 2013. You see in the last section under transfers out, there's the $48 million transfer on the middle of that lower box. Do you see the $48,000? That's $48 million that gets transferred from the Healthcare Access Fund to the general fund, if it has the money. The Healthcare Access Fund is actually not fully funded. And so in 2013, it only transfers $2.6 million. Used to be about $8 million, I think that's what you said. So any benefits to the Healthcare Access Fund in the next bit of time there would actually generate a higher payback to the general fund. So if we get $10 million of benefit to the Healthcare Access Fund from some phenomenon we could conjure, that generates $10 million of general fund. That's not ordinarily the case, except if we're not fully funding that transfer. So that's, did I say that okay? Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that sounds right to me.
And Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Vogt, it's interesting to me that our collections on the premium tax are actually less than what we expected when, you know, we have a, as you said, at least a 3% increase in medical expenditure cost trend. And that says to me that less people are insured and that eventually we're going to probably see some of those circle around here when they have health issues. I don't know. I mean, it's not showing up right now in the trend data, but it's interesting to me because I've always assumed that the premium tax kind of went up with, you know, everybody's insurance premiums going up, and it may be shifts in the market as well, but I thought we should note that because I don't think we've seen that for a while.
Yeah. Well, Representative Loeffler, it could be just that people are paying more attention to their funding. If there's more HSAs and like that, they're actually spending their money more carefully.
It could be a different policy type. You're right.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I share your concern, too. And just so you know, we're not going to debate health care today. And this is, we have 3 minutes left of this segment. Epson Gottwald, you can ask your question, though.
It's not a question, Mr. Chair. It's a,
somehow I knew that.
It's a response. Representative Woffler is correct. There are many factors that could be impacting that. It does not suggest that people are losing insurance coverage. I know there's a desire for public programs versus private sector, but that would be a misread of the facts, frankly. I don't think they say that at all.
So. Representative Woffler, do you want to counter? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I was just pointing out as a piece of curiosity that needed more investigation, because it's just not a trend we've seen before, and I think we need to understand what's happening in our marketplace.
And, you know, maybe there would be an opportunity, as the session goes on, we could even have a little health economics update and just get, we haven't had our annual health economics speech from the, whoever does that now, Department of Health still, I guess, if our bill doesn't pass. anyway, they could maybe come after we finish some of our deadline stuff, and that might be productive and have that just to keep us current. So, anyway, any other questions for Ms. Vogt? It's nice to have some positive news, and except that we want our $5 million back. So, thank you for coming. We have two bills. Oh, Representative Hosh will take your bill up. And while he's coming, Representative Lanning has been dying to have some minutes in his name, probably. So he'd like to move the minutes, and he notices that Representative Hayden's not on the list this time, so that's good. So
good.
Okay, thanks. And any questions about that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Lanning. Representative Hosh, you have a bill, and you have some witnesses. And we've had just to restate all the hopes we might have. We plan to do a funding bill. I don't think we have any funding that's a net. This is a project that I'll kind of steal a bit of your thunder. Just some things that'd be nice to do if we had some money, and these are some of the projects we've taken on are small and are not impossible. And so I wanted to give Representative Hosh a chance to present this idea. I'm a co-author, and it'd be nice if it could work. So anyway, Mr. Representative Hosh, time is yours.
And Mr. Chair, if we could start off, if I could move there's a delete everything amendment, the 812 amendment.
Oh, first you want to move the bill for possible inclusion and then the DE. So that would be
I will move House File 2198 is for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill and then make the motion for the 812 amendment.
Do you want to explain the amendment?
And the 812 amendment, I just think more, recognizes the Aliveness Project for what it is, the mission that it holds, and the statewide impact that it has, and just more accurately reflects the project. It doesn't change any of the funding, any of the base, any of the appropriation.
Okay. Any questions about the amendment?
Nope.
Anybody want to testify about the amendment? Good. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's in the shape you want it, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be brief because the testifiers here before me are going to be able to, in a much better way, exemplify what the Aliveness Project is for and why it's important. But essentially, this is a $250,000 one-time appropriation. In no way does this be included in the state space, so it's not going to affect our next biennial budget. One of the areas of importance and why I'm honored to offer this or author the bill is because of our continual push to serve populations outside of an institutional setting and to provide community assets and programs that help support people in time of need that will be reduced costs and I think in a way that people prefer to be served. So that is why I'm an author of this bill. I will allow the others to testify about its impacts and its importance and be happy to answer any questions afterwards.
Thank you. Mr. Hancock, do you want to go first?
Thank you, Representative Chair, or Mr. Chair. My name is David Hancock, and I live in Golden Valley, Minnesota. I'm here today in my capacity as a volunteer with the Aliveness Project and as a citizen in the state of Minnesota. Sitting to my right is Joe Larson, who's the executive director of the Aliveness Project. And I'm actually going to defer initially to Mr. Larson to share some of the demographic and outcome information from the most recent year of services that were delivered by the Aliveness Project. And I will follow up with that, and then we would like to introduce you to a few individuals who need and use those services of the Aliveness Project. So
So, Mr. Larson.
Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having us today. My name is Joel Larson, and I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'm here to testify in favor of House File 2198 and urge your support. I have the privilege of having served as Executive Director of the Aliveness Project for the past 10 years. And you should have a handout in your packet that gives some information about Aliveness. Last year, the Aliveness Project served 1,602 unduplicated people living with HIV/AIDS in Minnesota. That's twice as many as we served when I first started. Our services empower our clients to be self-sufficient and meet basic needs. Our meal program last year served over 32,000 hot meals in our dining room. We offer 10 meals per week, Monday through Saturdays. We have a food shelf that last year distributed over 50 tons of non-perishable food items and hygiene items. Since our founding, over 1.5 million combined meals have been provided by our food shelf and meal program. Volunteers make up the heart of Aliveness, people like David. Each year, over 1,400 people volunteer over 33,000 hours of service. We would actually have to hire 16 full-time staff to do the work that our volunteers do. We also have case managers who help hundreds of clients gain access to employment, housing, health insurance, medical care, and other resources that help them live independently. Our integrative therapy program offers thousands of treatments such as acupuncture and massage that reduce disease symptoms and treatment side effects and make it possible for people with HIV to stay on the treatments that they need to be on. So the Aliveness Project makes a daily difference in the lives of those we serve. This is so important because even though we've been living with HIV for over 30 years, the stigma of HIV is still there. In fact, we had one young man who initially had agreed to testify this morning or this afternoon, and after thinking about it, decided he was afraid of who might find out that he had HIV and backed out. You're going to hear from some other individuals today who will tell you more about Aliveness Project and about how this disease affects people in Minnesota. We also have a number of people in the room who are wearing red ribbons, who are clients and volunteers and constituents and support the work of Aliveness here in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I also want to thank Representative Hosh for his sponsorship of the bill and, Mr. Chair, for your signing on to the bill as well. Representative Hosh made a point in his opening remarks about the value of the services provided by the Aliveness Project and the impact that they have in preventing more costly out-of-home placements for individuals who are diagnosed with HIV and AIDS. And I just wanted to share a couple of stats on that note before we introduce some of our witnesses. And this is listed on the handout that Mr. Larson referred to as well. 90% of the members that were surveyed for the annual report last year indicated that the services of the Aliveness Project assist them to live independently, avoiding a more costly out-of-home placement. 90%. 76% of the members surveyed indicated that the services of the Aliveness Project, quote, make it possible for me to work. So it allows individuals to stay in their communities, actively participating in the workforce as taxpayers. And 80% of the members surveyed indicated that, quote, these services help me keep working at my current job. Again, there's an employment impact, and that translates to a Main Street impact as well. At this time, if it pleased the chair and the committee, I'd like to introduce Cornell Mitchell to join us at the table. And Cornell is currently an individual who uses the services of the Aliveness Project.
Hello, Mr. Mitchell. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. I'm Cornell Mitchell, and I currently live in South Minneapolis, District 61 and 61B. I would like to take this opportunity to give a couple of my personal experiences. I've been afflicted with HIV since 1996, and the Aliveness Project I can't begin to tell you what they have done for me, and I'm a veteran, and I found out about the Aliveness Project in January of 2000, because I go to the VA hospital here in Minneapolis, and Dr. Thurn is my doctor, and Nurse Bev, I don't even know her last name, I just know her by Nurse Bev. They told me about the Aliveness Project and what a great job that they do for the community. And so I've been a member for 12 years, and they've helped me live independently and eat properly. It's a nutrition that I care about, and they have meals Monday through Friday, both lunches and dinners, and also Saturday brunches. They also help me to live independently at home by a food shelf once a month, so I get that 12 times a year. They've also helped me with classes ranging from disclosure at the workplace, because I'd like to keep my job, what I can say and what I shouldn't say at work, alcohol abuse, because we can also fall into a pity train because of our disease, and I want to make sure that I don't fall into that, so that's helped me out considerably. There's also other services that I really like, and that's massages, because I'm afflicted along with HIV. I've also got lipomas all over my body, and I get them taken off me about every 3 to 6 months. And for, what am I trying to say here? I'm nervous. Excuse me. Massages help me maintain the circulation. I should probably just read. I've all written down here. Another thing that they've helped me with is me and my partner of 8 years to live in affordable housing. I can't stress that enough, to where I don't know where I'd be today if it wasn't for the Aliveness Project recognizing me and my partner and helping me get into affordable housing. I may be dead by now, and it's not that pity. I'm not trying to get pity from you guys. I'm just trying to do the realization where I would be if it wasn't for the Aliveness Project helping me out and giving me that sense of independence and a sense of community. So, again, I just can't stress what they have done for me and my partner in the last 12 years. It's a vital part of my community. So, with that said, in closing, I want to thank you, Chair and members, for giving me an opportunity to just speak in front of you today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hancock, do you have two other witnesses?
Mr. Chair, if it please, I'd like to introduce Hazel Erickson.
Well, Ms. Erickson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And thank you. Pardon?
They featured you.
I said to Tim, you didn't put that on.
If you're curious, the picture's on the back of the handout there.
I put the picture on there. I have a funny feeling I'm going to pay for it later now.
Anyway, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and representatives. I am from, I should tell you my name, right?
Please.
Hazel Erickson.
Of course, it's on the paper. We could have read it there. You
know. Read it, okay. Hazel,
I know.
Erickson, and I live in downtown Minneapolis, the Loring Park area. I may not come across as the person that you would think of as having HIV and AIDS. I have been infected for 16 years. And more women are becoming infected with HIV, mostly colored Hispanic women. But I'm neither one, but I am older, so that makes a difference. We're all living longer, too, which is a plus for all of us, even at my tender age of 70. In 2001, I moved from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Greater Minnesota. I was there to care for my mother, who was 81 years old. She's now going to be 91 on the 15th of this month, so happy birthday, Mom. I struggled to find services of any kind up in the northern part. I was told they didn't have people with HIV in their areas. They did. and they heard from the mouth of the north that they did. I managed to tell them, okay? I'm a feisty woman, so trust me. So I came to Minneapolis for my services and my health care. And while I was here, I found out about the Aliveness Project. What a blessing that was. It was just like a little light bulb went off for me. I was told that I could get all sorts of different services. I now live in Minneapolis, so I can be closer to the Aliveness Project. And I tend to spend a lot of time there. I go there for my massages. Lucky me. Sometimes acupuncture. And I use the food shelf because my EBT card of $16 doesn't go very far. I've had case management, which have been very helpful to me. The massages and the alternative therapies are available for me, but also for the people in Greater Minnesota. But it's harder for them to get down here because of the expense of coming to Minneapolis, and also the price of gas, as we know, is real high. And when you're living on a limited income, it's very, very hard to be able to get enough money. I know going up to where my mom lives, where I'm going to do this afternoon, is going to cost me about $60. So, you know, that's a big chunk out of a small check. Then I want to top it all off with telling you about our Christmas boxes. Every year at Christmas time, they give us a box that's about like this, and it's filled with gifts for us, some little food items and other little goodies in there that help make our Christmases very special. I would like to thank you all in advance for taking the time with us. We appreciate it. And by the way, any of you that would like to come and have lunch with us, it's on me. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Mr. Chair, if you please, our last witness, Clyde Cross. Hello, Mr. Cross. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the representatives. My name is Clyde Cross. I'm a native of Omaha, Nebraska, but I moved here to Minneapolis in 1987. I'm also a veteran. I served for 8.5 years from 78 to 85. Seen a little action in Grenada. But after getting out of the military and finding out my status in 1996, I guess I waited a little longer than most, not knowing that I had HIV. So in 1996, I was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS and given 2 weeks to live. So I sat before you today as a miracle in my faith. The Aliveness Project was introduced to me shortly after I arrived here in Minneapolis. It has been there for me spiritually. It has been there for me financially. It has been there for me as a family, because all those that are wearing red ribbons to me at the Aliveness, we are family. We may not have the same biological parents, but we share a lot of the same things as far as this disease within itself. Financially, I cannot express how much the Aliveness have been there for me. I was a professional chef for 30 years, and I had to leave my job due to my illness, especially dealing with food and serving people. And you know, you get a little cut, and then you got to go put on a Band-Aid real quick. And you know, I stayed in that as long as I could, and then I had to give it up. But once I gave it up, I didn't set in with pity, because the Aliveness Project was there for me. And again, the food shelf, the massages, the mentality, and having going to the meetings that they hold sometimes to just talk about things in general, that helps us along through everyday life. So I am definitely for this HF 2198, and hope that Aliveness can get it and continue to, even after me, people that come after us, will be able to experience the same service that we have this far in life. So thank you very much and for having us here today.
Mr. Chair, in closing, I would just say that, you know, obviously from the statements of the witnesses, the value of the services that are provided via the Aliveness Project speak well for themselves and are life-changing and life-sustaining for many, many individuals. This modest allocation that we're requesting, the $250,000 one-time allocation, and I'm sure you're sitting there wondering, why are you asking for that money now? The Aliveness Project has been very fortunate in that it has found a new home because it has grown so dramatically over the last several years, and the number of individuals served and the volume of services provided and the frequency of services provided, that they've outgrown their current home. And they've been lucky enough to find a new home in South Minneapolis. And the $250,000 one-time allocation that we've requested will provide some transitional funding while the organization prepares to move into its new digs. So that's why we come to you at this point in time with the request. We are also hopeful that this one-time modest request will open the doors for other donors to make larger donations as well to assist in that transitional period. So, and it, I would, any closing statements from Mr. Larson, or we will be happy to take questions.
Mr. Larson, Representative Hosh.
I just want to emphasize that we serve people throughout Minnesota, and the number of people living with HIV, both in the state and in the U.S., has grown significantly over the past number of years, mostly because of the treatments that we now can offer people. There are more people getting infected, but people are living longer, and that's the good news about HIV/AIDS. But for many people, it's still a disabling condition. Or they rely on us to be able to live independently in the community. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lott, do you want to say something, Representative Hosh? Sure.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for your time today. And you know, during times of limited resources, I know it can be difficult, but this small request can leverage countless of hours of volunteers. And just to put things into perspective, of the 1,600 people that are served, the request is well under $200 per person. If you can just envision that one less trip to the doctor or to the hospital because of the services provided will have dramatic returns on our investment. And we need to look forward to how do we maintain and serve people in their home and in their community instead of other costlier, more typical situations, and this is a perfect example of how we can leverage our dollars. And I appreciate the committee's time and hope by the end of session we can call this a success.
Thank you. We have time for a couple questions. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our witnesses. I've had friends served by and people who have served as volunteers and leaders in your organization, and I appreciate the work that you've done. What's inspiring this is a capital campaign. I'm wondering if you've completed your capital campaign or if state bonding might, given that this is a bonding year and you know the forecast, we have considered bonding requests from other nonprofits that are providing human services and whether that's an option for you.
Yeah, Mr. Larson or Mr. Hancock.
Sure. That's certainly, Mr. Chair and committee members, that certainly would be a huge assist. We are at about $900,000 that we have raised so far with our capital campaign. Our goal is $2.5 million. It has been a very challenging environment, as you can appreciate, in terms of a capital campaign. And our goal is to try to raise enough to be able to move to start the renovation of the building and move by the end of this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple quick questions. I think I got a little bit with Representative Loeffler in regards to the capital campaign. What is, just to give context, what's your current budget?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, our current budget is just over $1 million. It's about $1.1 million for this calendar year.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Okay, that does it. Thank you.
Representative Gottwald, you have a question or a statement?
Mr. Chair, it'll be a statement. I think in light of what's been presented here, it was a it was a good idea to just thank Representative Hosh, the people from the Aliveness Project, and the testifiers. Really appreciated your stories, and Representative Hosh, thank you for bringing this forward. Very much appreciate what you do.
Thank you, sir. I didn't mean to be glum. Thank you, Representative Cotwell. Any other comments for the and to the witnesses? I really appreciate coming forward. Any other questions for members? Okay, well, it's held over, and do our best. Thank you, sir.
I got to say, thank you.
You're a good guy.
Thanks for being held over. Yes. As always.
Well, Mr. Chairman, welcome. We'll be able to continue the rest of our committee hearing today, and on the agenda at this time is House File 2425.
Thanks. I'm sorry to. We'll let them just transition out, maybe, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. And then,
I've been giving them a little bit of time, but sometimes it helps to have a voice saying,
"Oh yeah, okay,
we're ready to move on." Help them also. And
so, Madam Chair, this is a. There's a few parts of our healthcare provider networks or systems that are undermanned or underpersoned or whatever. One of these is in the mental health field. In the past we've created a whole level of licensure called licensed professional counselors, licensed professional clinical counselors. When dentistry is undermanned, we created the dental therapists. And there's just not enough psychiatrists to go around. That's what this bill is about, especially for people who are being served by medical assistance. And it so happens that there's an easy way to fill the gap. There's a group of highly productive and well-trusted clinicians called physician's assistants that work under the auspice of under the direction of a psychiatrist. And the purpose of this project is helping get paid in medical assistance for their work. We don't have a line of witnesses we could bring forward to tell you about the problem, but there are, maybe the testifier probably has some thoughts about that, but there are people who sit in places for days and weeks, a long amount of time, and not being properly overseen, this is, I think, one way to address that. And so, Madam Chair, just to get the bill in order, I'd like to move House Bill 2425 for possible inclusion. And it's my thought that this might result in a small savings, and we'll see if that comes true. Mr. Hoffman seemed kind of optimistic about doing good work on our bills and making reasonable and generous, not issues of generous, but efforts to find, to see our rationale. So the amendment, there's two amendments, and this is a bit of a work in progress, and you'll hear a bit of controversy as the witnesses unfold, but I'd like to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order I'd like.
So moved.
And maybe I'll just, this is the first hearing, so I'll just, let's just move that, and then we can discuss it. Let's adopt that amendment, and then we'll take testimony, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Abel, Mr. Chairman. So, members, you have in front of you the DE1 amendment. Without objection, it appears. And so all those in favor of the DE1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. DE1 is adopted to House File 2425.
Thank you. And if you read the DE2, you'll see some of the breadth of just the different views about this bill. But I brought that forward just so people can know this is under discussion, and I think we'll come to a resolution quite soon. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier. Who can introduce herself and has a lot of interesting data for you.
Welcome to the committee, and for the record, just state your name and your title.
Yes, my name is Tracy Kaiser. I'm a physician assistant.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 2425. Again, my name is Tracy Kaiser, and I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants, the professional association representing Minnesota's 1,500 PAs. I practice inpatient psychiatric medicine at Regents Hospital, where I also direct a fellowship program for PAs in psychiatry. This 12-month program includes postgraduate training in diagnosis, psychopharmacology, and in multiple psychiatric subspecialties. The aim of this program is to provide strong didactical and clinical experience to physician assistants in order to extend psychiatric care. Physician assistants haven't had legislation in front of the legislator in the past two sessions, so I'd like to briefly explain who PAs are and what we do. PAs are licensed healthcare professionals authorized by Minnesota state law to practice medicine with physician supervision. PAs may perform any service that a licensed physician has delegated to them, including the prescription of medication. The education of PAs is modeled under physician education, and their grounding in T-practice and ability to expand access in virtually any setting, which makes them ideal members of the healthcare team. Just over 40% of Minnesota's PAs works in family practice and internal medicine settings, while nearly 60% work in specialties such as orthopedics, general surgery, specialized surgery, emergency medicine, and psychiatry and other fields. PAs work in inpatient hospitals, outpatient clinics, and other community settings. It's very likely that you've seen a PA. PAs provide health care services across the entire health spectrum and with every age group. Seniors enrolled in Medicare, parents and kids enrolled in Blue Cross Blue Shield or some other private insurance plan, and patients covered by medical assistance. As Chairman Abler mentioned, PAs cannot provide mental health services to MA patients in the state, even though we can provide mental health services to Medicare and private insurance patients. What does this mean for patients, and why should this concern you as policymakers? For MA patients, the fact that they can only be seen by psychiatrists for obtaining or renewing a prescription means that there is a large backlog of MA patients waiting for care. Medication monitoring and management is a key component of treating mental illness, but these medications must be adjusted based on an individual's patient's needs. Waiting months for the appointment to get that adjustment is too long for a person diagnosed with severe depression, anxiety, or bipolar disorder. There is little doubt that timely access to behavioral health care is becoming more difficult for patients to obtain, and discrepancies in how these services are reimbursed only make this worse. As an illustration, let's say that you and I are both discharged from a behavioral health unit. As a Blue Cross Blue enrollee, your first follow-up visit could be within 5 or 6 weeks from today with a PA who practices under psychiatric supervision. But let's assume that I, on the other hand, am an MA patient being discharged today. Because an MA enrollee only can see a psychiatrist, that appointment for medication monitoring and follow-up treatment may be delayed significantly based on the psychiatrist's availability. Imagine that you're a patient with severe depression and your antidepressant medication isn't working effectively. Now imagine having to wait to get it adjusted. That's the result of the current law that we seek to change. In addition to helping MA patients get more timely care that can prevent crisis and expensive readmissions, this bill has a potential for cost savings in the MA program. Since PAs bill at 90% of what psychiatrists bill, allowing the cost for these services will be 10% less than what the Department of Health Services is paying now for the patient visit a psychiatrist. Finally, I'd like to note that the legislation only applies to PAs supervised by a psychiatrist and doesn't modify the supervision of PAs or their scope of practice. It also doesn't allow PAs to provide any diagnosis or treatment that they can't provide today and does not define PAs as mental health professionals. The Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistant Leadership has had multiple meetings with several mental health provider organizations who expressed concerns with our efforts to amend the law. When they initially offered no alternative language, we came with the language in the amendment you adopted earlier, reflecting changes based on the concerns they raised in our meetings. New alternative language has been proposed yesterday, but we are concerned that the alternative language will be more restrictive for PAs than the intent of the original bill. We are willing to continue our conversation as necessary to further clarify the bill's language and hope to draft further language in the future. In conclusion, this legislation brings parity to the behavioral health care services that Minnesota PAs provide in an effort to ease backlogs and expedite access to care. I hope that you will support this legislation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kaiser. We have a couple questions, but Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. Perhaps Ms. Kaiser could relate for the members of the committee and as the public just what their supervision looks like on a day-to-day basis. There's a discussion about the amendment that you saw that we didn't adopt, the DE2, talks about site-specific places, and it's my view that it's hard to regulate that. And in my mind, the safety in this project is the integrity of the psychiatrist and his supervision of his pretty much staff as he or she would oversee the PA, because these individuals already can do psychiatric holds. Emergency holds, and they have a great deal of authority that they're given, granted in an agreement that's between the provider, between the psychiatrist and the PA. which is unique to each individual agreement, would be up to what the psychiatrist intends to trust the PA with. So maybe just on a day-to-day basis, Ms. Kaiser could comment about what that looks like so we know they'll get to my level of comfort about this relationship.
Ms. Kaiser.
Yes, Madam Chair. Members, thank you. In an inpatient setting or an outpatient setting, a physician assistant practicing under a psychiatrist has the ability to touch base on any case that they have, whether it be by phone or in person. A supervising psychiatrist has the ability to delegate multiple services for a physician assistant. In my practice, specifically with complex cases, I come to a psychiatrist with each one. I want to be able to practice the top of my license and have the psychiatrist just be able to do the complex cases. And so we kind of work in that setting where the psychiatrist feels more comfortable with a one patient load than another. So we kind of work in that setting.
Well, Ms. Kaiser, on a follow-up on to that, in regards to physician's assistants, in regards to this particular physician area, the mental health psychiatry area, you probably know a lot more about other physician assistant practices. Is there any other area where you have a doctor involved that physician assistants have this same kind of lack of ability to practice? In other words, orthopedic physicians use physician assistants. OBGYN, family practice, there are many of them that commonly use physician assistants. So is this the only area where physician's assistants cannot practice in that same sort of way?
Madam Chair and members, yes, I do believe that specifically in the mental health field, PAs are unable to be being reimbursed by MA just in mental health, not in any other specialties.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Kaiser. That is helpful information. We also have Representative Gutwald with a question or comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nope, this will be a question.
Okay.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I understand there is some ongoing work on this, some compromise that's represented by the DE2, and I understand you not wanting to bring forward the DE2, but how are you continuing working on this? But I really hope you continue working with the mental health folks, because I know they have some heartburn over DE1.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald. If you look at the original bill, my goal is to find a way to compensate these qualified professionals under medical assistance and make it functionally practical to do that. And so if you, our first, when we got LPCs and LPCCs covered, we called them mental health professionals. They went through an upgrade in their training. That was probably not the right way to go. And that generated some of the heartburn because of that criteria. That gives other freedoms which we didn't intend, like the overseeing of staff, et cetera. And so, which is why you see the more narrow language, which simply qualifies this individual to do the work in any setting that they find themselves under the control of a psychiatrist. I think that this is probably close to where it's going to wind up, but we're happy to continue to work. You know, that's my style. And so, but I think limiting it to a site is problematic for billing. And so it just makes it complicated, and I don't think it gets us to the top of the license, which is the effort that we're trying to do, and get the flexibility in the service you might need. We might have forgot a site to list. You have a new law, a new site. The list is quite inclusive anyway for sites, and I'm not sure which ones aren't listed there. But that's where we're working. And if you have any advice, I'm willing to take it from you two.
Thank you. All right. Another question we have is from Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think this is an interesting bill. I'm kind of torn about it because I think that psychiatrists, I mean, kind of their major role is prescribing and prescribing for people to have mental health issues. I am trying to figure out, and maybe Representative Abler, I mean, are there, so who's against the bill? And I'm trying to figure out, so I'm trying to figure that out. And then I worry about kids that are on medications and kids that are seeing psychiatrists because as they're growing and as they're changing, their meds can get out of whack. And so will a physician's assistant be as capable of assessing, particularly with young people, what is happening with them and what those, you know, you start tinkering around with medications and you can have pretty severe ramifications. So so I'm kind of wondering where people are falling on this, and it has a feel to it that I would have concerns.
Representative Abel or Ms. Kaiser, I do think that there are physician's assistants who also work in the pediatric area and other sorts of settings, if that is correct.
And Madam Chair, there's another witness which will probably help to clarify some of the concerns that are out there. But just to tell you that Medicare and the private pay side already cover this service. So it's not a new horizon of care. And I believe there are just individual-specific, not site-specific. And you haven't heard a word about people that have 3M insurance. Probably if you went to your clinic under the CGIP, that they could have a PA working in this capacity doing this task. That's all we're asking, is to extend that into the MA world. Mm-hmm. For the people, that's the point. Maybe we should take the testifier.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like at this time that might be a good thing to do. And so Tricia Smith, Ms. Smith? Stark, sorry. Ms. Stark. Okay. Welcome to the committee. And for the taped record, if you just would say your name and title.
Okay. I'm Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a licensed psychologist and executive director of the Minnesota Psychological Association, and thank you. I'm going to start with the end point and then work down. I wouldn't say we were against this bill, but we are wanting some modifications to it. We certainly recognize that there are access issues and want people on medical assistance to be able to get care, but we want it to be able to occur safely. And with due respect to Representative Abler, I do think that settings are important. The thing that I want to avoid is having a physician assistant in a setting with no backup. I'm perfectly comfortable having a physician assistant in a mental health setting where there are other mental health professionals around who can provide backup. In our field, we get curbsides all the time. We walk out of the room and we say, gee, I have someone in there and I'm just not sure. What do you think? And while they can call a psychiatrist, that's different. It's different than being able to call someone into the room if you need it, if you're really stuck. And there's a real difference between their training and how they're supervised as compared to ours. Mental health professionals have a master's degree or higher just in a mental health field, plus 4,000 hours of closely supervised experience. And when I say closely, we meet 2 hours a week face-to-face with our supervisors for that 4,000 hours. It's not on the fly. It's one-on-one. So that's a little different. And we have 2 years of classes just focused on mental health. And the nature of the licensing, as I understand it, for PAs is that it's based on their supervisor, their psychiatrist's, and I don't mean this to sound snarky, but it's based on the psychiatrist's hope that they're going to do good work and their fearfulness of malpractice suits. But it's not based on something in statute that says what their training must be. And it's wonderful that they have a fellowship program. I think it's great that they're instituting that training, but it nowhere is it necessary. And so I support their working in mental health settings where there is backup. It needn't be a psychiatrist. It could be a nurse, could be a social worker, family therapist, psychologist, but just somebody with more training in case they get into trouble. And a phone call just won't do it. The other thing I just would correct is it's not just psychiatrists that see people with medical assistance. Nurses can also see people with medical assistance, RNs and clinical nurse specialists and nurse practitioners.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Stark. Appreciate your taking the time to come down today. And we have a question, Representative Abler.
Well, Madam Chair, and we're working this through. We're close to some new language that's close. But I agree with a lot of what We work with all these professionals, and whenever you get an interface about some of these matters, it gets a little dicey to make sure, you know, that it's properly done. Mm-hmm. We're still working. So, and maybe the Ms. Kaiser wants to say something, and then you can take a question from one of the members.
Mm-hmm. We'll do that, Ms. Kaiser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members, and thank you for speaking. I just want to say that in each setting, a supervising physician and a PA works on this delegation agreement together, and it's up to the psychiatrist of what we do and their comfort level and our training. And so I just want to let you know that this is something that, depending on the psychiatrist and what we're delegated to do, in each setting, and it's not our goal to be going into an area where we don't have backup. We always have the supervising physician with their level of comfort in how we're doing.
Thank you, Ms. Kaiser, and that is true of all PAs, correct? Isn't it
correct
that you only have the scope given to you within your own statute, but also directly by the physician supervising? Is that correct?
That's correct, Andrew.
All right, thank you. Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I also think this is a really interesting bill, and we all share the concern about the lack of availability of services. I guess my question, first of all, Representative Abler, you were kind of getting to it, and I was going to ask you before sort of what's missing, what setting is missing from the DE2 amendment. I'm not sure, and I'd like to know that, but also I wanted to ask Ms. Stark, you know, my understanding here from the presentation is that the only thing the bill is really doing is allowing them to bill for something that they can already do the work. So I kind of wanted to ask you about that because I hear you and I think your concern is very well taken. We don't want to, in the interest of saving money, we don't want to have people get care that doesn't do the job and that's substandard. You know, we certainly don't want to go there. But, you know, what about the fact that all this is doing is letting them bill for something they already can do? And then I want to know, maybe you can answer the question about what settings aren't in the DE2.
I think the settings
Dr.
that
Stark.
Are... I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I think the settings that are not included would be to go beyond those, and it would be all freestanding mental health facilities, which would expand it, for example, to mental health centers in greater Minnesota that aren't attached to a hospital but would have other mental health professionals available. And I think it's a little misleading to say all private payers reimburse PAs for mental health. For example, Medica does not. Blue Cross, I know, does, but I don't think all of them do. And I think this is the reflection of the concern that there's a safety issue involved.
Thank you, Dr. Stark. Representative Liebling?
That's fine.
Okay. All right. Now, Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question was in line with Representative Liebling's as well, but my understanding of this bill from talking to some PAs a couple weeks ago is that, of course, they are certified by a physician, so they're very capable of doing the job. And when it benefits, of course, the mental health patients who can see a physician assistant in a two-week time instead of a six-month time because of the lack of mental health physicians who are able to service this group of people. So the merits of the bill is very important, and I support and want to vote for it. My question is, it also gives us the opportunity to save some monies, and anywhere that is a possibility, we'd be silly not to look at those. Safety, of course, is a main concern, and you've already addressed it because they are certified by the physicians. So the question is, is it somewhere in by law, or is it the Department of Health and Human Services that set that rate for the physician's assistant to bill, or are they able to, I presume they're not able to increase the rate in time, but it's set by the state, is that correct?
Representative Abler, do you want to take that?
That's what we think. Yes. Yes. Oh, with a yes from the back of my head.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. A group yes, I see there, okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I saw Tom shaking his head, so I knew the answer before you, Representative Abler. But
okay. Madam Chair, we're probably out of time, but Alina put a letter out, and they are thinking this is a good idea, too. So just
okay, we'll recognize.
And this is being held over to work on, and so that's the intent. I appreciate all the dialogue. I'm all ears on advice. So
thank you, Representative Abler, and coming to the end of our time, this House File 25...
No,
2425 is held over for possible inclusion, and because we are at the end of our time, we are adjourned. Thank you.